Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 667, May 2023.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell, and this is one of those episodes, you know, we've done almost 700 episodes, and since the beginning, this has been one of the ones I'm like, one of these days, I'm going to do that episode. I have, for decades, listed the 14-episode, two-season, barely, ABC mid-80s television series Max Headroom among my top, all-time top five TV series, and haven't done a podcast episode about it until now. Joining me to talk about Max Headroom, all of us live and direct from 20 minutes into the future, are the following wonderful people. Monty Ashley, hello.
Hi, Jason. I love this show.
I do too, Monty. I do too. Moises Chuyan is here. Hi, Moises.
Jason, you wouldn't download an education.
Warren Fry joins us. Warren, welcome. Hello.
Yes, hello. Hello. This is kind of weird to admit, and I'll probably refute it a little later, but this is one of the reasons I became a journalist, this show. The other one is Kermit the Frog and his reporter outfit, so I don't know what that tells you about me, but
flip a coin on that. But no, it's very meaningful. Cicero Holmes joins us as well. Hi, Cicero.
I'm here to make sure that the ratings stay up.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what about the people? What about the damage? What about the loss of democracy? Forget all that. What about the ratings?
Clunk, clunk, clunk.
And our special guest, a Max Headroom expert, the co-host of the 20 Minutes into the Future podcast. What? It's Austin Rich. Austin, welcome to The Incomparable.
Me? Humble, modest, shy little me on The Incomparable?
Okay, so let me take you back to a time when there weren't very many science fiction TV shows on or anything like Max Headroom on the air, especially on network TV in the mid-80s.
Yeah, this aired on ABC.
This aired on ABC.
ABC.
Network, yeah.
Yeah, it's before Star Trek The Next Generation came back in syndication. It's many years before Fox realized that they could try a bunch of weird, sometimes very bad sci-fi, fantasy, techno, horror, whatever shows in the Friday night time slot, which, you know, your VR5s, your Freaky Links, your X-Files. Oh, hey, that one worked.
I think it's before Fox existed.
Yeah, well, it might be right about when Fox started to exist. Anyway, it's a way back there. And, you know, as a sci-fi fan, as a kid, or as a teenager, when Max Headroom came on, I knew Max Headroom. Of course, people in the day knew Max Headroom as a commercial pitchman. He had a show on Cinemax where he had little bits and played music videos. He had the Coke ads, but nobody really knew anything more than that. He was sort of a very strange, amorphous zeitgeist figure. And then along comes this show, which was based on a movie that nobody in America had seen, a TV movie from the UK that was adapted for the American hour-long TV format, really kind of like straight up, directed by Rocky Morton and Annabelle Jankel, the directors of Super Mario Brothers.
They never miss.
That's a very cool TV movie that I think I actually rented on VHS at some point.
And so then did I. I totally did.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. So it was adapted and turned in. I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw that ABC had taken that and had made a whole TV series out of it. And watching back now, I am just as amazed that this was a thing that aired on network television in 1987 and 88. It's hard to believe, I mean, on so many levels, hard to believe that this got on the air, let alone was inexplicably renewed for a second season. But, you know, that doubled the episode count. So good job, Everybody,
most of that budget went to those helicopter shots.
Helicopters. Yes.
Oh man,
and the one explosion,
and the one explosion with many the angles
one,
many
that angles. They reuse over and over in many a few angles. Episodes.
So I want to. I mean, there are lots of things I want to talk about. Obviously, about Max Headroom, especially the subject matter. I feel like some of the subjects that are covered in the show are so prescient, this 20 minutes into the future, that they're still issues that we deal with or are starting to deal with today. All of this time later, which is, I think, really remarkable. But I wanted to start, having rewatched this show and asking all of you this too, for your impressions of this, by what an interesting mixture of stuff is in here, because there is some amazing production design where there are sets that are really weird and strange. Everybody's computers are like with typewriter keys. There's the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy style of what gets displayed on computer screens, including episodes where we're like this is a TV show where computer hacking is an activity that happens and that matters. And as we've learned over the last 30 years, it's terrible to show that on television or in movies. And yet, somehow, they've done that. And there are things like the helicopter and the explosions and the wastelands that they're in that you think, oh my God, they spent so much money on parts of this show. And then there are other parts where I sit there and I think, you couldn't do a second take? I find it amazing, but what my mind erased over the last 30 years from this show is all the parts that are not so amazing. And it really is like all over the place, like if bursting full of ideas, interesting production design. All the cars are Studebakers. Like there's so many weird things going on here. And yet there are also these things where I'm like, well, that was cheap. They only did that in one take. That dialogue wasn't very good. Right. And it's just, it's a,
hey, lay off them, lay off them. Jason, yeah. You're being mean to a good show that was just doing its
is.
Best. Come on.
Yeah. It is. There's parts of it that are.
Allow me to concur with Monty. Shut up, Jason.
all right.
It's just
667 episodes that I wanted to do this, but I will be quiet now. Go ahead.
We'll get back to you. We'll get back to you. But let me stand up for these lovely people who started the thing with the TV movie that was made for Channel 4, and then they were given an American TV deal and had to scramble and suddenly like put together an American TV show. And I totally get them blowing money on the absolute wrong things. And the thing that I love so much about the show.
What do you mean, wrong things?
Well, the wrong thing, as in you spend most of your budget on helicopter shots and a couple of explosions. I'm saying subjectively, okay? They probably missed that money the moment they realized, oh, that was radically more expensive than we had expected. What I love is how much they do with so little in some places, and how the extras that you find on Shout Factory's marvelous special edition produced
great,
by my buddy Brian Ward.
Great DVD.
Absolutely yes. Great. But I loved getting more detail on how really just like rubber banded and taped together various things were. Where, okay, we're shooting this thing tomorrow. We have no location for it. We're going to find a location by the spillway and we're going to turn it around overnight. And to me, the show is that much more miraculous when you get just how literally flying by the seat of their pants they were making this thing. It's even more of a shame that it got shut down so summarily that they just shut everything down literally in the middle of they finished a take and they shut the whole thing down, and then they took over a bar and they filled this bar after having been canceled, after having been told by ABC, okay, you've been spending enough money for enough time, not another dime, get out of there, stop. To me the most miraculous thing about this, on top of all of the great actual content of the show, is that they pulled this off.
Yeah. I mean, I think the production design of this, it definitely needs to be mentioned a little bit because, you know, the kind of pieced together nature of it is due to Leslie Frankenheimer, who was the production designer on Blade Runner as well. And so that was one of the ways where they wanted to spend a little bit of money to kind of get a big name for the show. And I mean, it looks great in terms of the typewriters, in terms of the screens on screens.
All those old
the
weird
lighting
cars.
In the office, which and I love the lighting in the office.
Oh,
where
yeah.
There's just spotlights just outside the window, and they've got the windows slatted, and there's a whole bunch of smoke in the office.
Smoke machines.
Just like every office.
20 minutes everywhere. Into the smoke machine. Everywhere.
Gary, can you call the office smoke guy? We don't have nearly enough smoke
in
the office.
It is so hazy.
I want to emphasize this for anybody who hasn't seen the show. I love the look of this show.
Yes.
It's so amazing. Mm-hmm. The production design is where they spent the money, and they should have.
Yep.
That's where you get the most bang for your buck. Even when nothing is going on, you can just look at the sets and go,
And even when they don't have a great set where they have to be, there's one shot that I noticed in a season 2 episode I was watching today where they're basically in like a concrete block area between two doors. And they're like, how do we make this interesting? And they're like, they got extras wearing weird hats and weird coats and like a rickshaw and like a hot dog cart. And they put it all in there. And then Edison Carter, played by Matt Frewer, who is also Max Headroom, walks through it. And it's sort of handheld and it's staged in such a way that it feels like he's in like a very busy street where there's a market going on. And I'm watching it thinking, wow, this is not the most lavish set, but they have done what they can to establish this. Because, again, this is not set in our world. This is set in a bizarre future time where there are Studebakers, but also the computer hackers. And like large portions of the population apparently live in a wasteland with nothing but TVs and oil drums full of burning trash. That
destroyed
is the
environment.
World. Yeah, that is the world of Max Headroom. So you can't just fake it. You can't.
It's I mean, overall, it's a very British show with a thoroughly American accent and a Canadian lead.
Yes.
And I love all of the mixtures of things at play. And I hope it was clear that I was mostly joking about them not spending the money right. I think just knowing what helicopter shots cost, that might have bought them another couple of episodes.
Yeah.
Had they done a couple of helicopter shots and reused them, because I am frankly amazed at to Monty's point, how intricate and wonderful to look at, even in standard def, all of these sets are.
Yeah.
It feels like a completely lived in world that looks like it cost 1,000 times what they actually spent on it.
I mean, in 1987, a lot of shows wanted to go into Airwolf mode, so I can't get too mad at them for that.
I had that. This was the first time
that two helicopters.
This is the first time that I was watching and I was thinking, well, you know, it was the 80s. There's, you know, your A-Team and your Magnum PI and your Airwolf, and like having a helicopter was cool. But it's not just that they have a helicopter; they have the Network 23
with
chopper. Where I wanted to point out that there's a scene in the season 2 episode where Edison Carter is at home and he's going to go out on a story, and he tells Theora, Amanda Pace, wonderful as his controller, Theora, have Martinez pick me up. And I thought, wow, now that is a Network 23 expense account. He's not going to even go to the scene or come into the office. They're going to send their helicopter to pick him up at his house. Oh, to be Edison Carter.
I don't think he can drive. They never show him driving or anything.
Oh, he only drives in his dreams.
Why would he?
Oh, that's right.
In his dreams, he's driving. So you guys have been talking about what this show is. I kind of want to talk about what this show was for me.
Oh, yes, please.
So I obviously, as a red-blooded American, remember Max Headroom and every, you know, all the different permutations outside of the one that happened in England. You know, it was America. America was the only one that matters. but for the last 35 years, so I watched the show when it came on ABC. But for the last 35 years, this show has been a fever dream for me.
Mm-hmm.
Where all of these things happened, but also the events of the 1990s John Wesley Shipp's Flash also happened, combined, featuring Amanda Pace.
Right.
So just in my brain, I just see Amanda Pace, and sometimes it's the Flash. And then sometimes it's Edison Carter, and sometimes it's Max Headroom. And I don't know where any of those things stopped or like interconnected. I believe they're in a connected universe mm-hmm. somewhere mm-hmm. in my brain.
No, Cicero, we live in the real world. Cicero lives in the Amanda Pays connected universe.
Yeah, that's right.
That is correct.
So you have it even further compacted in your memory.
That's probably a Star Labs experiment that combined the universes at one point. And
it might have been a Bitvert.
Yeah, it could have been. Recently baseball teams started doing ads during the game, like in the inning. They'll be like, and now we take a moment for a 15-second break for a word from our sponsor. And, you know, those are Blipverts. I call them Blipverts. The idea of the Blipvert has stayed with me. And like, we live in a Blipvert era now, straight out of the original TV movie and then the pilot. Warren, haven't heard from you. You're someone who's lived through the 80s.
Yes, indeed.
Did you enjoy revisiting this from the perspective of the future, 20 minutes into the future?
Everything you guys said was true, although it is weirdly timeless and very 80s at the same time. I'm not sure how it pulls that off, but it does. Like, you can, other than the hair, you're like, this doesn't necessarily have to be in the 80s. It's kind of, but parts of it are. Like, I remember watching the pilot, which I did yesterday, and I'm like, wow, Carter is definitely a bit of a Me Too. there's a bit of a creep factor here.
And that kind of
fades away as the show goes on. But there's one episode I just saw today where he sees Theora with somebody else on her picture phone and he gets all freaked out. I'm like, well, this is something that would be dismissed out of hand mm-hmm. or never written about in 2023. But in 1980, whatever, everybody's probably taking his side, which is odd. You know, so just things I was noticing that I definitely didn't notice at 15 when I first watched it.
In one of the later episodes, Murray just suddenly puts his hands on her shoulders and her reaction is very clear that she was not expecting it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, Tambor, you did not know how badly that was going to age.
It's the bad touch. Yes, Jeffrey Tambor is in Max Headroom for those who didn't know.
On the other hand, as somebody who's worked in television, a toxic workplace, you don't say.
You don't. Yeah. No. A toxic workplace in the news environment.
Exactly.
I was going to say, I was going to talk about the sexism in the show and say it is the 80s feminist sexism, which is, look at us. We're so forward thinking. Our show has a lady controller and then there's Janie Crane, the lady reporter. And look at us. And it's like, yeah, but you called her the lady reporter. So, right. And so it's like, don't pat yourself
on
the back
too much.
Janie
Crane disappears after what, two episodes?
She's in two episodes, but still the what you end up with is this moment where like, yes, Theora is great. There's that moment where Bryce Lynch, the official hacker of Network 23, watches her work and he's like, you're good. And she just smiles and it's like, that's all great, right? Theora is a great character. And yet also,
also there's a whole episode where the plot is that Edison is mad that she went on a date with someone that's not him, even though they have no romantic chemistry together.
Right. Yeah. That was a template for an 80s, 90s, network TV episode.
They were on after Moonlighting. Yeah. So they were kind of trying to tap into that, I guess, a little bit.
On the other hand, another thing I noticed is that Bryce is clearly autistic, right? They don't really, and unlike Barclay, or there's probably numerous examples, but that's the one that comes to mind, they don't make fun of it. It's just kind of who he is, you know?
No, they just make fun of him though, right? Like, it's so weird, watching the 80s, I feel like Bill Gates saw himself in Bryce when he was watching him.
Yeah. Sure.
And was like, you know, one day, guys, I'm going to show him. And he was in the process at that point. He was already in the process of showing him. But you've got to imagine that in, 35 minutes into the future, Bryce is like, he has like revolutionized the television game and he's kind of running everything now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Back to Theora for just a sec. Something weird that I enjoy that doesn't fall into any of the sexist stuff, but that is just plain weird and is one of my favorite kinds of things like it throughout the show, where it'll be a weird thing that is never touched on again, is in the pilot when she brings the not actually dead Edison Carter back to her place. He wakes up in a bed covered in a weird array of stuffed animals. Uh-huh. And it's a huge bed. Just with maybe the strangest arrangement of stuffed animals framing him that you could have. And the only way that it's commented on is just kind of a little look as he wakes up, and it's not commented on whatsoever, and we never see it again.
Never mentioned.
Just random weird stuff like that. One of my favorite things about the show.
Also, that's Edison's house. even though it's supposed to be Theora's house. But later on, when we go and we see Edison in his house, it's the same house.
Oh, weird. Well, you're saying they reused the set and they redressed it as her house or something?
Yes.
20 minutes into the future, everybody lives in the same apartment.
They're all designed exactly the same. Right. Yeah. Weird. There's only one.
There's one apartment. Four people share it. Everyone else is out on the streets.
Yeah.
Living in a van that broadcasts as a network.
Trash bins. Oh, the vans. There's so many good vans in this.
There's the Body Banks van.
There's the Big Time TV van. There's so many good vans. Monty, you and I have been on some podcasts where we've talked about cyberpunk movies and things like that, right? And this is, I mean, this show, if it's got any big kind of fictional influence, it is cyberpunk as a genre. This is hackers, and there's ice at one point they're trying to get through, and it's very Neuromancer like in some ways. Max Headroom, our title character, although he's not in it as much as you would think if you haven't seen the show, he's sort of comic relief and occasionally a plot element, and he's kind of fun, but it's not really the point of the show. But it is very cyberpunky. And Monty, I was trying to think, like, Johnny Mnemonic, and like a lot of cyberpunk film in this era was unsuccessful, and Max Headroom somehow actually manages to do it right. And I can't think of very many good examples of the cyberpunk genre in filmed media, but Max, I think, is the top.
That is because, and here's my thesis for the show.
All right.
Max Headroom is about television, but television is a metaphor for the internet. Which is impressive, as there wasn't really much of an internet to be a metaphor for at 1986. Right. But like, they've got AI, they've got an episode about deepfakes. This is ripped from today's headlines. Yeah. And it's because it's all done in metaphor, that's why it works.
Deepfakes.
Because instead of being like, hacking is typing, television is visual. Replace all the typing with television stuff. Hey. Brilliant.
It is. You mentioned the deepfake thing. There is this question of, like, who are the police and who do they work for? The security systems episode, and like, what is that data and surveillance data and CCTV data used for? There's the concept of the blanks, who are people who don't want their records and their private information used against them and used to track them. There are so many of these elements that are current today that are all explored. And you're right, it is through this lens that's kind of charming, which is the idea, like, this world, we haven't really described the world other than the wastelands and the burning trash and the helicopters, but this is a world where apparently there is no government other than TV networks, and that you elect somebody to represent your TV network, or your city is, every network has a representative. It's this weird dystopia where it's all about TV networks controlling everything, and there are dozens of them, and there are computer systems and security systems and all that, but we don't know really what happened to the world, but it is super messed up. And then in the midst of it, we have our main character, Edison Carter, who is a crusading journalist with a camera that is a live satellite link, which is another example of them prefiguring the future of media and news gathering, that he is live, a one-man band live, reporting his show, and that has come to pass, essentially. Like, it's such a weird setting, and they're tackling so many issues. But I love, Monty, you saying that the TV network is kind of a metaphor for the internet, which didn't exist yet. That's right, because the idea here is that it's an interconnected universe of TV and computers, and everything talks to everything else, and that's what the world of Max Headroom is. So good.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
There's so much that's wonderfully kind of, as you mentioned, kind of prefigured. Fake news, vaporwave, the way that police dress. They show regular police officers dressing like riot cops, which is how they dress now.
I love that the Metro cops wear batting helmets with catcher face masks. That's their uniform. It's amazing. Yeah.
It's also prefiguring like YouTube streamers and niche broadcasters.
Sure.
Zoom calls. There's a wonderful Star Trek Zoom call with a few future TNG cast members in it at one point. like there's like so much that's like weirdly prescient. Even the smart plumbing, where in the first episode, Theora is hacking through the plumbing, which for years I used to laugh about.
Yes.
Until now, they have wireless plumbing in big cities to help detect fatbergs. And you could absolutely hack them if you knew how to do that. So, I mean, there's so many things that became true even when they were kind of like stretching and coming up with ridiculous things that like, I mean, I keep returning to it as a source of like, wow, that. And that one, too. And that, too. And
Edison's coffee maker at one point makes an appearance and it says, no beans, no beans. And I thought that was just so great. It's like stupid, smart coffee maker. It's like, you know, it's Alexa, basically. Shut up.
I mean, part of the way into season one, you know, his identity is intentionally edited to reflect him being guilty of credit fraud, which is noted as being worse
crime.
Than murder.
Oh, no.
It's worse than murder.
Yeah. The greatest crime of all time. Credit fraud.
Yeah.
That episode, though, the brilliance of that is when everything is computerized, if somebody can change your record, reality changes, right? That's what that episode is saying, is that they rely so much on their computer records that if you change them, it doesn't matter if you're innocent. It doesn't, which is a theme that comes up several times. There's also this show does repeat themes because there's also the episode where Blank Reg gets put on trial, and it's a similar thing, which is like, well, once the records have been altered, the computer records, you know, reality doesn't matter anymore. It's whatever's in the system is reality.
This couldn't be a more thoroughly 1987 Thatcher era British hard sci-fi show than if they they did make a reference. They used the name Thatcher and said something or another about someone named Thatcher being out. The punk vibes of Blank Reg.
It's old just punk. Before there were old punks, he was an old punk.
Who gets the best lines? That man was born at 50, by the way.
Morgan Shepherd, one of my favorite character actors, and is so great in this. So I met him.
He just muscles his way onto the show, doesn't he? Like, there's no. Originally, Rick Ducommun and Jerry Burns were going to be the regulars, and you can see them go, guys, step aside. More Blank Reg, more Blank Reg.
This guy we brought in from the UK version, just kind of like for window dressing, is so good. And so he passed away a few years ago. I met him at Comic-Con, and he was in the autograph. It's the only Comic-Con autograph I've ever gotten. And so he's got his stack of 8x10s. He says, which one do you want? You want the Star Trek? You want the Babylon 5? And I said, oh, Max Headroom. And he's like, good man. He said, have you got the DVDs? They really did a good job with those. And I have had for several years now on my wall in my office. I'm looking at it right now. 8x10 Blank Reg, signed by Morgan Shepherd. I love Blank Reg so much. And
jealous.
His terrible TV station that he runs from his van with Dominique, who he loves like a sister because he was always into nuns, where it's like hour after hour, day after day, making tomorrow seem like yesterday. And he says, that was crap. Now more of the same. And he's just playing music videos and he doesn't care. It's so good.
I always say that. Next up, more of the same. Nobody knows where it's from, and I'm fine with it. But he has the best lines in the show, frankly. Like,
absolutely.
He really does. Old he really punk, does. And I mean, Whackitz in season two, his defeat at his audience continuing to want to watch this stupid game show and not Sex Pistols videos.
Right.
He plays that so well. I mean, he really, it's almost like he's not acting. It's like Morgan Shepherd is just really disappointed that people don't want to watch the Sex Pistols. And that episode's made even better by the also not really acting that much, Bill Maher playing a terrible salesman doing horrible things.
Yep.
Who would have thought?
I think Bill Maher was just accidentally on that set and they just said, stick around.
He just came with the set dressing.
That was the era where, you know, they were like, all the comedians' agents were like trying to get him cast in things as actors. And Bill Maher did this and they're like, okay. Go back to comedy. I don't know. Some other things that I wanted to mention, like, well, we should talk, before I get to my little bullet list here, we should talk about Max Headroom, the character, because you know, Max Headroom really has gotten flattened to being one of those things that's like, oh, it's so 80s. Oh my God, it's totally 80s, right? And it's strange because in this show, he is tactically deployed. They don't, I think, overuse or misuse Max. I mean, he's got his little bits. Also, again, how did this get on the air? He's got his bits at the end where he makes fun of commercials right before the commercials.
Yes. Commercial, right.
Absolutely.
That's
beautiful.
Amazing. But that he is, you know, he is a
pure filler.
He is an AI clone of Edison Carter, but he's kind of like an agent of chaos, and he is used as a MacGuffin and as a plot point and as a magic key that unlocks things and all those things. But he's also just fun, and he pops up in a world where it's illegal to have an on-off switch on your television. They must always remain on, which is just so great because they have cameras and they look at you, but it doesn't matter. They have to remain on. Max just it's a free floating agent of chaos. He pops onto Network 23 and comments on the shows, which is great. He's like a pop-up video, essentially. It just, if anybody has thoughts about like how Max is used, because I think for the title character of the show and this iconic piece of 80s culture, I am always amazed at the restraint they show. It's not about Max Headroom, right? It's about Edison and Theora and Murray and Mr. Cheviot in the boardroom. But and then Max is just around. He's just like a mascot almost.
Watching it this time, I had a thought that he is kind of like some of these latter day Star Wars droids that are absolute chaos machines, but he's not restricted by having a body. And he is the character that everybody, you know, really their fandom is centered around, despite the fact that they're ostensibly a bunch of people having, you know, a big important plot happening. This is just malevolent enough droid causing a little bit of havoc here and there and just having fun. And occasionally being very centered and, you know, taken over by this or that or that kind of thing.
It's like puckish. He's just there to like, yeah. It's like a Shakespearean like comedy bit. Like he appears and does stuff. And yeah, sometimes he's important.
He's also the first reaction video, but actually, unlike most reaction videos, I enjoy watching what he has to say.
I don't think he reminds me much of Edison Carter. They keep saying he's based on Edison Carter's personality. Is he? Because Edison Carter is at one point described as acerbic, which is the perfect word for Matt Frewer's vibe.
Yeah.
And Max Headroom, I would describe as a lunatic.
Yes. And a TV personality. I read it. I think the show tries to make it that basically he's got access to all of Edison's memories. But yes, he is a lunatic.
But they keep saying it's his personality. They say that over and over again.
Monty, there's that one moment in one episode where somebody says, "Oh, you look a lot like Max Headroom." And in that one moment, Edison's response is the most Max Headroom like he is in the entire show.
So I think it's kind of brilliant, right? Because you wouldn't want Edison Carter and Max Headroom to be the same, right? Even though they're played by Matt Frewer, they're played by the same guy. By the way, for those who are wondering, how do you make Max Headroom in 1987? And the answer is you put a lot of like styrofoam and makeup and stuff onto Matt Frewer and put him in a green screen box. And then you do some video editing and then you claim he's the first computer generated. But it's literally just massaging the poor Matt Frewer. I remember when Max was on David Letterman's show and it was very clear at one point that Matt Frewer was, you know, taped up behind the scenes and then appearing on a TV screen on the set. Last report, and I don't know, a lot of things have changed fast in the TV industry, but at last report, the person who created Halt and Catch Fire, the TV series, was working on a Max Headroom reboot on AMC. And the thought I had, and that Matt Frewer was going to be involved. And the thought I had was, well, the beauty of it is you could computer generate Max Headroom today from Matt Frewer. And he wouldn't have to put on the styrofoam.
Yeah, he's a VTuber.
Yeah.
The one thing I kind of realized with Max Headroom was I felt like maybe the writers had ideas that they would use that Max would be a more central character in the beginning of the series. Mm. And as the series evolved, they realized that the stories that they wanted to tell didn't necessarily need Max in them.
Right.
And it was taking too much energy to try and figure out how Max could be the central MacGuffin for each particular episode to allow them to tell whatever story they decided that they, you know, they wanted to tell. And they just stopped doing that, right? And they just let him be an agent of chaos.
Do I dare to suggest that perhaps Max Headroom was the thing that got the show made, but the producers actually wanted to do a dystopian social satire?
That late series episode where network censors are the big bad was very much a part of what making that show was like.
Amazing.
Because the network censor, like they were running so fast and loose, just slapping everything together and getting it done. Network standards and practices couldn't clear anything until it was already, you know, up on the boards. And that was something that they started to run into toward the end of that run. And I mean, making the subtext text in that respect was just delightful.
On that note, I wanted to talk about male skin, if that's okay. this show does this weird thing where they sneak in some profanity. There's some sexy mannequins engaged in some interesting behavior in one scene. So many risque jokes. And then when it comes to showing any amount of skin on the show, it's always Matt Frewer. It's never anyone else. And there's something about this show where that's like, we really want to kind of try to push all these different TV standards in ways that are not how you're going to expect these standards to be pushed. And I really appreciate that scene, especially where, you know, you think you're going to get the blanket thrown off of Edison and you realize that he's wearing boxers underneath. And there's this like actual moment of like, are they going to actually just show naked Matt Frewer on the bed? They might.
Hold on. I mean,
that was season three. That was actually, for sweeps for season three, but they,
for sure.
You know, we've kind of danced around it and you talked about it a little before, but this show was weird, right? Duh. The weirdest part about this show is that it wasn't episodic in a way that other shows were episodic, where, like, you know, the things would happen, we laugh, we fade to black, and we reset to one for the next episode. This show would end, and like at the end of that episode, there would be stakes, right? There were things that mattered that happened in that particular episode. And then you reset to zero, or you reset to three, or you reset to like sometimes it carried over, but most of the time it didn't. And then like there were things that happened, especially today, right? Watching it now, when you're binging it, when everything is fresh, right? Like I know what just happened because I just watched it 5 minutes ago, not a week ago. Like you're expecting someone to talk about the thing that happened, because there were like traumatic episodes in this show, and you're expecting that when you come back to the next episode, someone's going to be talking about it. And they act like it never even happened.
Right. No, every episode is like a little movie in its own little universe. I was struck by that too. I don't know a lot about the history of the production here, but it strikes me as that they. That the first off, I having compacted this all into one big blob, the first season seems much more kind of considered in some ways, and the second season seems like a mess, which I think is probably a function of them getting a surprise renewal, because mostly on the back of being after Moonlighting and getting pretty good ratings, because the turnaround from being a mid-season replacement to having episodes in September, I would imagine that order happened and they were not ready, because season two scripts, at least especially at the start, there's a lot of duplication. We were talking about this before we got started. There are a lot of things in Max Headroom that happened two or three times. There's an old friend of Edison. There's technology that's used. I mean, let's count them down. They enter your dreams. They read your dreams. They control your mind. They addict you in some way. Like every time, every time the Dream Thieves episode, I watch that, I'm like, oh, this is the one where Edison gets addicted to being in like the car with Joan Severance. And it's like, no, that's Neurostim. That's two more episodes later. Like, okay. but they're like the same thing. Literally the same thing happens in both of those. So
there's two episodes that address schools and education. There's two that address women's health. There's two that address how the politics of the world work.
Weird future religions in a couple different episodes too.
Yeah. Mm, yeah. And there's actually kind of two shows happening, really, because there is the weird will they, won't they show happening in Network 23 that is isolated away from the rest of the world of the show. And they're having this kind of like moonlighting style show happening in a dystopia. And you're like, what is happening here? Why are they're playing breaker ball and then wait, now they're in the fringes and it's what?
Yeah. I have a theory on why the second season is less tight. And I will sum it up with two words, sports night. I will now explain those two words.
Okay.
First season, good. Not good ratings, but we'll give you a renewal. We weren't expecting a renewal. Quick, reuse scripts.
Yes.
Oh, God, now they hate us. Quick, start doing episodes about censors.
Yeah. No, it's pretty clear looking at season two that they were kind of caught. It feels at least like they were kind of caught flat-footed, and they do not go to strength in season two. It feels a little more regressed and diffuse than it did. And plus they're like, let's bring back all our characters from season one. So it's like Jerry Burns and Rick Dukeman, come on back. Charlie Rocket. Yeah, we'll do an arc.
We haven't seen you since the pilot. Why don't we bring you back and name an episode after your character nobody remembers at this point?
Here's a guy who's a recurring villain or something. I think he's in there like three times. ?
Yeah, Simon Peller. He came back. Oh, he lost the election this time. Well, remember that episode from last? You don't? Okay. Well,
I didn't remember his name, but he looks kind of familiar. I guess. Something I'll say to defend the writers a little bit is that opening that second season with the young, powerful minds unbound sort of education thing, they're telling a different education thing than what they do later in the season. And what I feel like probably happened was the monetizing and completely commercializing access to education was something that they went, we want to put this in this episode too. You know what? We've got a full 45 minutes. You know what? I think we can paste that together with a couple of other little things and get another episode out of it.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Let's figure this out. It's like none of it's unwatchable, but really can, as you say, you can see the seams and you can see where they went. We had too much roast for dinner. Let's save some as leftovers and it'll taste just fine tomorrow.
Right. And it's different if it's on weekly and maybe 5 weeks later, you don't really remember what you saw before. But when you're binging it, essentially, you're like, oh, this is sort of like that other episode that I saw two episodes ago. And it is a little bit. But that was in watching it back. I thought they got surprised. Maybe some of those early episodes feel actually like they might have even been scripts that they commissioned for season one and didn't use, and so they're like, well, we'll just that Academy episode is sort of set up in the last episode of season one, but it's all interesting and good and weird, and like I think even a bad episode, and I don't think any episode of Max Headroom is particularly bad, there's always something interesting to look at. Even the ones that are a little more pat and a little more like an 80s drama are this is a show where like if you're bored for a minute, just pay attention to what's on in the background, because one of my favorite recurring bits in all 14 episodes is what is on television. Now, the show is about Edison Carter being on television with the Edison Carter show. And you're like, what I want to know is what happened in apartment 12B. And we're going in there and we're going to solve this and we're going to have somebody live and they're going to be revealed as being bad live on TV. And it's great. But when Edison's not on the air, pay attention to what is on television, because it's bananas. It's like animals and very weird game shows and extremely and something called Lumpy's Proletariat at one point.
That's the best one.
Oh yeah, that's my favorite.
Poodles on Parade.
But amazing. Look, none of them hold a candle to Porky's Landing.
Porky's Landing,
the true drama of our time.
Very, very popular.
They shot like 15 seconds for and just aired that 15 seconds over and over through the entire episode. You mean?
Yep. That's right. That's right.
But that's drama.
It's so good because it's a TV show saying what's on TV is terrible, right? Hello, you're watching TV. What's on TV is terrible. And let me tell you, over the course of the 30 years since the show has been on, they're not wrong. Like, it's sort of
more right than ever.
Yeah. I mean, the belly dancer with the pigs, that I think that's on the Discovery Channel now. Like, I think it's all happened.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
When they brought Grossberg back in season two and made and were trying to fashion a regular recurring big bad villain for them to, you know, work in opposition to, the thing that I enjoy most about it isn't how well it works, but how beautifully typical of 1980s, 1990s ineffectual big bad villain recurring thing that it is. So like even the most pat thing that they did in the text of the show, it's still enjoyable enough, and it gets not even to the edge of wearing out its welcome, but you know they know that it's tired, they know that it's pat, they know that belaboring it too much is a waste of time, but you know, hey, I'm glad they gave Charlie Rocket some extra work.
Yeah.
I mean, the text part of this is interesting, cuz like I often think about it not necessarily as a show with continuity or that we're necessarily supposed to follow the story from episode 1 to episode 14, because so much of it is kind of like film noir. It's like, let's put this mode on TV and then tell a story in this mode. And I think that allows them to like break the fourth wall. It allows them to have all these meta references. It allows them to kind of like take the show into different storytelling places. Mostly because they're not necessarily worried about, okay, what was the name of the helicopter pilot in the previous episode? We got to make sure that they match up.
Gun it, Martinez. Gun it. Come on.
Yeah, there we go, Martinez. That's what it was. You know, I think that they're much less worried about that kind of stuff, because to them, it's like, well, we want to have like this fast-paced news environment and tell a story in that mode.
I love the fact that there's an episode where the signal, there are two episodes, sorry, again, everything comes in twos. There are two episodes where the network signal is taken over by someone else, and one of them is the Academy where they're zipping, but there's also in the Blanks episode, the Blanks take over the signal of Network 23. This is amazing because, of course, also famously, a guy wearing a Max Headroom mask took over a PBS station in Chicago. During Doctor Who.
No, it was WGN.
WGN, yeah.
Oh, was it WGN?
Yeah.
WGN, was it on during Doctor Who? I thought it was on during Doctor Who, or did they do that too? Warren might.
Yeah,
know.
WGN.
I think it was the WGN incident came before
the PBS.
Interrupting PBS.
Because there were two. There were two.
Like
yeah.
Yeah, everything. There's two. Yeah.
Right. It's just like Max Headroom. So anyway, I love that there are two plots in which there's signal jacking happening on Max Headroom.
Because there's two Edison Carters, Edison and Max. All works.
And then a guy in a Max Headroom.
We're figuring it all out.
It's all connected.
Duality.
Anyway. Yeah. It's anyway, I just love that reality and life are all doubled up there.
Art imitates life.
I wanted to say something about something I really didn't love, and then I really super didn't love rewatching it, which is all the Oriental racism.
Yeah.
It's the '80s.
You know, I loved seeing Michael Paul Chan getting that work early in his career. I loved seeing Saab Shimono taking over the zigzag chairman role in season 2, because there's only so long that an actor can put up with that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that there was a whole episode that like it checked off so many of the boxes of stuff that I hate,
yep,
especially from this era, with, you know, the specific sound of like background music that apparently we Asian people just have in the background everywhere
in
we
the background.
Go.
Yeah.
Commenting about how Network 23 is honorable. Oh, I'd forgotten because it'd been so long since I had heard Asian people on a show talking about things being honorable. That said, boy, it could have been worse, but it isn't great.
Well, it's like I said about the treatment of Theora and other women on the show is like, on one level, in the era, it's like they did some cool stuff with Zigzag that I really enjoy. They're so weird. And of course, this is also the era where the Japanese and the Germans are going to take over the world, right? This is the 80s. The American mindset is, oh, we lost it. Japan and Germany are ascendant in the future. Just like Blade Runner is like that too. It's this idea. And so parts of what they do with Zigzag, I'm like, well, that's really interesting, right? But then they're like, let's do an episode where we really put Zigzag at the front. And I watch that episode and I'm like, oh no. Like, oh no. Like, I could explain it away before, but now I just can't. It's just.
Yeah, brace for Orientalism. No. And it just, yeah. Every point where I was like, oh, they're done. No, they're not done.
Nope.
Here comes another. Yeah. And here we go. Lady dressed in a kimono, all right, serving cake. All right.
Uh-huh.
Well. Yeah,
it's unfortunate, too, because in the background cast for the show, in roles that on other ABC shows would just be all white, there is a lot of diversity in some of these smaller parts on Max Headroom. And so the show does this thing again where it undercuts any kind of progressiveness that might have existed by doing that with a very ham-fisted, terrible episode.
Guys, Blink is beautiful.
Blank. Yeah. So I was going to say that line makes me cry.
I was just waiting.
But that episode is great. Like, right. I love that. I think that episode and the war episode, which is the one right before it with the helicopter and the explosions, are the two most interesting episodes in some ways. The Blank episode is the highest level of television satire, right? This is where you get we learn the TVs are always on. There's that line about you smother technology and it rebels, which is really great. There's that moment in the boardroom where all the TV networks are off air and one of the people in the boardroom says, we need to get some emergency video players out there. Real humanitarian.
TVs are given to the needy, you know, so the play, yeah.
Without television, the city would become ungovernable is a line said in that episode. It's so amazing. There's also a man with a frog named God.
That sounds familiar.
And then that's the one with the deep fake in the end. Our heroes create a deep fake in order to make a politician say what they want, an elected politician say what they want in order to force him to do what. And this, Monty, I'll let you go in just a second because one of the things that's fascinating about that episode is sort of like we're kind of on the Blank side, and then they have to be like, but our heroes are good too. And there's literally a moment where Edison Carter says something like, You're right, but you're doing it the wrong way. And I'm like,
just
because
comply.
You know, establishment has to win in the end. Monty, go ahead.
Is Edison Carter a good journalist?
That's exactly what I was going to say. No. There's so much.
You know, I don't so know. Much, if, I don't know if we have an answer. I think the whole show is that with a question mark at the end of it.
Because half the time he is a shill for the network, which kind of bugged me. I'm like, well, they'll just make him go do stuff, or he just kind of does it on his own willingly. And half the time they will definitely bend the rules and not outright lie. But I mean, I was watching this going, I would get fired numerous times this episode for this. And rightly so.
He outright lies also.
Yeah.
Right? Like there
in the first season, half of his stories are about the network he's on, which seems very odd.
I mean, if this were to reboot, you know, years down the line, Edison Carter would obviously be the network chairman.
Right. Yeah.
He's, you know, it's playing on our views of what a crusading newsman should be. Right. He's like, I don't know, Mike Wallace with a sat cam is kind of what he's supposed to
yeah,
be.
Kinda.
But the show also knows that he's not quite that. Right. And in, again, there are those lines. By the way, the Simon Peller line, the politician who says the appearance of dispute is essential to the network's democracy. And he's like, I don't like that word appearance, right? I'm supposed to be. But there's also that line where he's like, since when has the news been entertainment? And Murray's response is since it was invented, right? Like, so the show, again, the show knows, but also the premise of the show is that these are our main characters are the people essentially in power for the network that is kind of running the city, unnamed city that's kind of Los Angeles, but kind of not. And it is it, so like in the Blanks episode, it really feels that way where it's sort of like the show is more radical than the characters are allowed to be. So they have to do some hand waving to be like, oh, no, I know we just said the blanks are good, but not quite good in the right way. So our heroes are okay. And it's just, it's a fascinating line that the creators of the show have to walk to be on ABC in primetime. Again,
Jason,
sci-fi shows weren't on network TV. They weren't on network TV at all. So how did this get on?
It's so important to color within the lines, Jason. You know, stray outside the lines for entertainment purposes briefly, but get back inside those lines.
On this script, a few notes about the war episode, which I mentioned is the explosions of the helicopters. That is also the episode where literally terrorism is packaged as entertainment. And the idea is that we're going to give you an exclusive on our interviews. And like, I find that episode unsettling because I feel like there are parts of it. I'm like, oh no, they're probably right about this too. And we'll see that in the next 20 years, right? Like stuff that hasn't happened yet, but will probably happen.
I have a quote from that episode, which is, "We're the first terrorists to use modern marketing theory." That just,
yeah,
oh my God. Okay, you got me.
Yeah.
Hey, right? Hey guys, what about Insurrection but Crystal Pepsi?
It looks so good though. I mean, it's not just that they spent money on wherever they shot this wasteland
LA, surprisingly.
Yeah, I know, but we're in LA. They found like the fallen apart buildings, and then it's all, again, in an era where this stuff didn't really happen. Like, you know, Traffic came out a decade and a half later, and suddenly everything in Mexico is going to be yellow for all time because they're like, we're going to color grade everything. It's all going to be. But Max Headroom, like that war episode and several of their other episodes, it's got crazy color grading. And I think they added grain to the shots. Everything looks weird and bleached and alien. And then you're in ruins with this helicopter. It is so evocative for a network TV show in the mid 80s. It's just, it's kind of amazing.
I have to give credit to the behind the scenes tech people because you don't see one flickering television at all. And there's so many televisions and they all have to be synced to film.
Right.
And they're definitely shooting at 24 frames a second. So, and TV it was not that. And that was a nightmare to do back then. So I was pretty impressed that I can't think of one episode where there's a flickering TV.
They're everywhere.
Every time they have a wall of TVs and Max Headroom is like popping up on one and talks to somebody and they talk back, then he goes away and pops up another one. I think, first of all, those are all CRT TVs. So they all stick like 3 feet back. And second, it must have been so much work to have Matt Brewer shoot all of this Max stuff in conversation with nobody and then have it show up on the screen at exactly the right time.
And do it in the right sequence so they could do, because a lot of this is playback. You can tell there are a few scenes where you can see that they shot like Theora watching her screen before they shot Max. And you can see it because he isn't quite matted right. They tried to mat him in, but he's not quite matted right. But most of the time it is, I think, perfect. And it suggests that they figured out how to shoot this stuff in advance to put it on the screen so that people could react to it and it's actually on the screen. And
yeah, well, they're doing that. They're doing that for all of the characters, I think. Because, you know, because all of those video phone shots are the same thing.
Yeah, the view phone. You
know? Yeah.
Which, again, feels a lot less alien now than it did in the 1980s. Exactly. Although they all have cords with the little curled cables, which is so adorable. It's like, it's like an old telephone, but also video phone. It's so good.
I mean, Matt Frewer really, I mean, he earned his salary on this thing playing both of those parts because on the one hand, he is the lead character in all of the live action non-playback bits. And then he also had additional days where he just got made up as Max Headroom and was shooting the reverse of all of this stuff and then probably had to go back and reshoot some bits of it that didn't necessarily work just right, but there's only so much that you can actually do.
Right. They probably ran out of time and they just ran with whatever shot they had before, because that definitely happened in a bunch of those.
There's a bunch of him just going, ha-ha!
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, yeah, I can see it. They do that in advance, and so they've got stuff that they can play back. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
They had to load tapes to run all of that stuff. It wasn't anything like, you know, pushing a couple of buttons on a MacBook.
No, amazing.
I think like people really forget just how much handwork goes into stuff before a certain year.
Oh, and the animation too, like for all the computer screens, like which there's steadily less of as the time goes on.
Right, and they reuse a bunch of stuff. But yeah, the vector style that was established in the UK TV movie, which they kept, which I think has its antecedent in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy TV series. But it looks great, and it feels like very specific to Max Headroom. They're not trying to be super high tech. It's wireframes and all that, but it allows them to do some of that animation. There is some stuff later, the stuff where Max is like in a ball that's going through a bunch of circles and lines, where it's like, you know, cyberpunk, how do you explain what it's like to hack? Like, I'm amazed at how dramatic they make hacking into a system, because
Jason, it's a series of tubes.
Yeah, well, we all know now. They didn't yet know that many movies would try it and realize that watching people hack into anything is boring on a visual medium. But they make it work pretty well.
It is astonishing how much of the show is people talking to each other on screens. And a shot of somebody with their face illuminated by a television monitor for quite a while. certainly there wasn't other shows that were doing things like that at that time. And I think that, like, you know, you guys are talking about like the getting these things pieced together where they're like pumping video into one room so they can have these conversations with old tapes that they've made of Max. And it's like, I think it speaks to the kind of punk spirit of making the show. Like, everything is do-it-yourself. They're throwing together things probably 20 minutes before they shoot the scene, not to pinch a time unit. But there's so much of it that is like just slapped together in the same kind of punk rock style that it makes total sense that almost every episode has background punks everywhere. Like, it's just, it feels like in order to be this kind of hands-on DIY, I think you got to have a little bit of Ramones playing while you're making the show.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things, talking about things this prefigures, we mentioned AI. As the chatbots have been going on, and there's also been stories about how they're going to be able to do a chatbot that like is based on the entire message and email history of people, you know, and then they die and they're going to be able to replicate it, which was, by the way, also a Black Mirror episode. But I'll just point out that in not one of my favorite episodes, which is the one where Edison's old girlfriend, Vanna, love it, Smith, who's the leader of the View Age Church. Right.
Right.
But they are promising people that they're going to scan and make these AI constructs like Max Headroom, basically, of their loved ones so they can bring them back and they'll never die. And I love it so much. And I think about it when I think about ChatGPT and things like that, because, of course, the punchline is there's that one old man, and anything you say to him, all he says is, yes, it's wonderful, isn't it? I love it so much. And like, and they talk about AI chatbots now, and I'm like, Max Headroom did it. You know what you're asking for. You know what you're going to get. You're going to get, yes, it's wonderful, isn't it? Over and
over
again.
ChatGPT-3, yes, it's wonderful,
isn't it? It's
wonderful. Now, Jason, we learned something earlier in the show, though, about how to defeat ChatGPT and the like. All we need to do is have Max Headroom seduce them.
Seduce them.
And they will all just submit to what we actually want.
Yes.
So that's it. Okay, so that's what place where Max actually gets used in the story. And I think those scenes are hilarious, and yet simultaneously I'm like, of course it's a girl computer, and of course she giggles because he's sweet talking her.
Of course anybody can turn her off, but only Max
can turn her on. Yeah.
Oh dear.
It did make me laugh though, but I'm also like, this is not right.
But then when you think about it,
yeah.
the way that it's a little bit more okay for me is I go, a bunch of sexist men created both of these things.
Yeah.
So yeah. It makes sense. It makes sense that the sexist tropes baked into what these sexist men put into them end up being the way to confound it.
Yeah.
On the subject of chat botulism, we certainly are in this scenario now where we're worried about this writer's strike and AI potentially vying for our entertainment dollar. And every time I hear these news stories about it, I just sit there thinking, like, we already had this problem in the 80s. Like, again, it seems to be so prescient in so many different ways that, like, even our most current news story is soaked in Headroomisms.
That's the thing I keep coming back to, and I'm enjoying this conversation because I've been telling people for all this time, is like, trust me, I know you think of Max Headroom as this old thing from the 80s. It could not be more current even now. It is so, it is of its time, but it is also so prescient about technology.
It's still 20 minutes into the future.
It's still, not 20 minutes. It's kind of like 7 minutes in the future.
Kind of like now. Right. Yeah, we've arrived 20 minutes in the future. Right. Jason, you're telling me that a show that regularly shows unchecked greed of capitalist CEOs trying to conglomerate all kinds of different businesses into one bizarre chimera of a mess is bad for society? How could that apply to anything that's going on right now?
Tune in on the next Lumpy's Proletariat.
Zing.
Monty, was this your first time watching Max Headroom, or did you watch it when it was on?
I watched, I'm pretty sure, a couple of episodes when it was on, but I did not keep up with it. So I knew I liked it. I had the bootleg DVDs that you could get at Comic Cons for a while before it was available, and then I got the DVDs when they were available, and then I finally watched it on streaming, like last month.
Yeah, so you can get the DVDs. You can also buy it. Yeah, you can buy it on like a la carte on Amazon and other places like that. You can get the episodes now. So there are ways to watch it, which is one of the reasons I didn't do an episode about Max Headroom for so long, is that it was hard to get it.
It's like when Syracuse made you watch a million episodes of Ghost in the Shell or whatever it was.
Yeah, it is. For years, what I had were DVDs that I burned from my VHS tapes I recorded. It's better with the ads in it, honestly, because the ads from the 80s are mind-blowing. Robot is Tobor spelled backward.
In the same breath, I was going to say everybody should get, I mentioned the Shout Factory special edition DVD, which you can still get. The interviews, like there's an hour long, you know, how the franchise got made, interviews with the cast, the primary cast minus Matt Frewer, a standalone interview with Morgan Shepherd and Ms. Tomei, his counterpart. It's one of my favorite Shout Factory special editions that they've done, because every single one of those supplemental pieces adds something of dimensionality to the show that I was completely unaware of, as many things that I had read online about it and everything.
Yeah, and Morgan Shepherd loved it too. I can tell you that, because he was like they did a great job with that DVD set, and they did. It's really good.
Here's my bona fides. I once in the 90s owned a Japanese Laserdisc of two episodes of Max Headroom that my dad picked up for me when he went to Japan on a business trip in like 89
That's
or so.
Wild.
So he went all over Tokyo to find this damn thing for me, I've since lost it. But I did have a Laserdisc with Japanese writing on it. It was great, and Max looking insane on the front of it.
Warren, he's not mad. He's just disappointed.
Yeah, yes. That's for this and many other reasons.
So Monty, I thought you would like it, but I'm glad to hear that you really enjoyed it watching it now back
I liked so much about it. Like the opening credits, it looks like a CGI city, but it's really just plexiglass buildings. I love that. Uh-huh. Like I love, like you said, the Church of the View age, because everything is about television. These guys say telly before words the way people in 1950s science fiction movies say moon or space. They have the telly elections are coming.
Yes.
And the way that late 90s politicians would put the word cyber in front of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Everything is telly, and I love it.
It is very much like, hey, you think the television is all there is? Oh, imagine what that would be like. And then it would be this horrible wasteland.
Yeah. It would be the way we are now, except without people doing bootleg television, we have Twitch, which is exactly the same thing.
Yep.
I also wanted to shout out one thing really quick. It's not relevant to anything except The Incomparable. Bryce at one point says he doesn't want to go on a mission because he wants to complete his collection of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
Yes.
I just wanted to briefly mention that Skeletor is his enemy.
It's yes, absolutely true.
Obviously. Also, only a dedicated collector would have their Masters of the Universe related, politics sorted out that way.
I want to mention, by the way, the politics of the White Brigade, the first terrorist organization to use modern marketing techniques, as mentioned earlier. It is, for the record, neo-radicalistic anarcho-syndicalism.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
A phrase used.
I was confused about it, but now that you say that, yes, of course.
More than once.
Anarcho-syndicalism. I've heard of that. It's in Monty Python.
Yeah. Well, this is the neo-radicalistic kind of anarcho-syndicalism that is very important.
Big difference.
Well, since we're talking about other media properties like Monty Python, I want to point out Morpheus's appearances in the first six episodes, or the character they call Rick.
Rick Shaw, who drives a rickshaw and is basically Morpheus from The Matrix, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can absolutely see them having watched this on TV as kids going like, I have an idea for a character.
The Wachowskis definitely were exposed to Max Headroom at a young age. I think there's no... I had that same thought when I saw Rick Shaw. Again, one of those, is it clever, character names where it's like, well, he's a guy with a rickshaw. We'll just call him Rickshaw. Well,
yeah. I mean, and they named the one guy Ped Zing.
Yes, exactly.
Well, there's a lot of signs that of, named characters in this show somehow.
Yeah. So Rick though. Yeah. He looks so much like Morpheus in The Matrix, that it has to have been, you know, burned in the back of somebody's brain. One of the Wachowskis, and then it became, you know, the Morpheus we know. But like, yeah, he's totally there. It's like, wait a second, that happens sometimes, right? Where you look back to an antecedent, and you're like, wait, this is like, oh, this precedes it. Oh, right. So I think that's there. He comes back too. He's like, their consultant in the wasteland. He's in a couple episodes. Rick is the knowing where.
Yeah, he's magic. He's kind of like Edison's fixer in a way.
In the fringes.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's like Edison can walk among the fringes because he's, you know, like an old noir detective, but he still needs a guide when he gets into trouble.
Right. Although really what happens is that Rick leads him to Blank Reg, at which point Blank Reg is on screen and everybody forgets about Rick.
Yep. Yeah,
Rick is one of those things that, you know, I wonder if, you know, there was a costumer in common between the productions, or if, knowing that Lawrence Fishburne is a giant nerd, he said, can I look like this dude, Rick, from Max Headroom? And the Wachowskis went, yes, that's
Could
genius.
Be.
Yes, we're going to do that.
Somebody somewhere saw it or had it lodged in their brain and it came back out again. Might not have even been conscious, but stuff like that happens. There's, you know, that's the, I was playing
the
video
kind of theft.
I was playing the video game, or the computer game Marathon, right, on the Mac back in the day, and realized that, one of the aliens is literally just a character from the Micronauts comic book. Like,
yes.
And it's just like, whoever designed that alien, they read that comic book, and they might not even have been thinking about it, but they totally read that comic book. And it's like, I love that because it means that something was bubbling in there and then it came out, whether it was conscious or not. And Rickshaw is like that. Yeah.
In the Infinity Gauntlet miniseries, Alf is in the background of a panel just colored blue. So it's a different character.
Yeah. It's totally not the same at all. Yeah. What have we not mentioned? I mean, there's so much. This is just an overview. We're not going to go through all the episodes. There aren't that many of them. They're available. I hope, at the very least, that people who are listening to this who have not seen it in some time, that you will be inspired to try it out, because it is, simultaneously, as we've said, very 80s and also very timeless and strange in a good way, and with foresight about where things are going and have gone. But what have we not talked about that any of you want to bring up before we wrap it up?
One very minor, like, dumb detail from the episode where Grossberg comes back is that as he's listing off the various members of the Network 23 people that he has grudges against, they all have given names except for Murray. Murray is just a one name guy. He's the Madonna of bald network producers. And I found that absolutely, like, cackle inducing hilarious this time watching it through.
He's just Murray.
One of the most British things about it is in that episode where they introduce Rickshaw, where he goes and his camera gets stolen and he goes, ah, bleep, that was my favorite blanket. Like, that's just not something you'd hear on an American show. You would hear it on a British show for sure.
There's a whole running gag about blankets in that episode. Like, it keeps coming back. Like, Edison's obsessed with blankets.
There's also, you could tell that the British people were involved, especially in the season one scripts, because American actors say lots of things that Americans don't say. There's some delightful just like English phrasing that happens and you're like, okay, I mean, it's fine, right? But it's just very funny where you're like, an English person wrote this and nobody told them to change it around for the Americans. So it's fine.
I found it interesting. The Dream Thieves episode, they're talking about this movie palace and a long time ago, people would all watch the same thing at the same time. And now it's people are watching the same thing at the same time, but then they're also watching something else alongside it, on multiple screens. And, even though it wasn't a one-to-one thing, it was something that made me go, oh yeah, that's right. People will go, yeah, I'm watching a movie and also playing Diablo 4 and also listening to the new Beyonce album on Spotify.
I want to give a shout out to the Church of the Subgenius reference that keeps happening over and over and over in that show with Ben Cheviot and his wonderful pipe doing his best Bob Dobbs. I think that is delightful. Every time it pops up, he works for Network 23. So there's like more Subgenius references. It's wonderful.
George Coe as Cheviot. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to shout out Gier Burns, who played Briggle. Yeah. And I loved him because I was like a 60-year-old, 14-year-old, because one of my favorite shows was Dear John.
Dear John.
Yeah.
I knew you were going to say Dear John.
Yes. And he plays the same character, and it's just because it's 20 minutes in the past, he's just a smarmy guy. But in the future, he's a smarmy guy who collects. He was like a ne'er-do-well, but I love them in both roles.
Yeah, he and Rick Dukeman are like ne'er-do-wells in the fringes, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's awesome. Like the first time we meet him, he's collecting a not quite dead Edison Carter, mm-hmm. who he knows is still alive, but they're gonna harvest them for parts anyway. And he knows who he is. It's awesome.
He doesn't care. In his van, one of the many vans again. Right. Lots in the future, there are many beat up vans, is what we've learned.
I'll make one more comment about the fringes, in that I just earlier before we recorded, I had to make a quick run to the store. And on the way, I had to drive past a really massive homeless camp, which unfortunately we have these in almost every city now. And it just strikes me as very interesting, as I've seen these develop over time in a lot of cities, and that's the fringes now. And again, we are finding so many things from this show coming horribly true.
We're only seven minutes from the future.
Yeah, it's actually watching the fringes. It's really hard not to think of it that way.
Right. Yeah.
And for something like, I was thinking about something like Blade Runner and some other kind of visions of the future ish stylish sci-fi visions from the 80s, and there's just, I don't know, there's something about the Max Headroom vision that like it feels closer to reality.
Enduring.
than a lot of other visions from that same time, including the contrast between what's happening in the fringes and then the rest of it, where they've got their big apartments with their enormous beds and all their stuffed animals and all of that, like, and these very comfortable things where the wealthy people are. It's very clear that that's part of the vision of Max Headroom. And are they wrong? I don't know.
No.
I want to, as we're wrapping up, I want to shout out ABC, who was audacious enough to produce this show for what amounted in the late 80s to half a season over two seasons. Mm-hmm. Like it shouldn't have been made. It couldn't have possibly been made. It obviously would not be made by a network this, nowadays it probably would be on, it'd be a web series or something, some series on YouTube.
Or on cable at the very least. Right,
exactly. as a penance for producing this show, ABC went in the opposite direction and released Cop Rock.
An audacious, daring thing to try.
Right. It is.
And it might take another 667 episodes to get to Cop Rock, but we will.
Well, here's what I was going to say is that ABC was willing to try lots of stuff. And while I do believe that Max Headroom, the series, got made because some executive somewhere, it might have even been Bob Iger, saw that Coke commercial and said, oh, that's interesting, let's do a show about that. And then they saw the show and they're like, what? What is this thing? But it gets great ratings because it's after the climactic episode of Moonlighting. And so they're like, I guess we can't get rid of it. Sure, renew it for 13 more. And they won't even let them make 13 more.
I mean, a show this prescient about corporate greed was so dangerous that Disney had to buy the network 10 years later. So I mean,
the other thing I wanted to say about the daringness of ABC in this era is that although they got a bad rap for doing things like canceling Max Headroom, they did make Max Headroom. They did allow it to get on their air. And although we can talk about Cop Rock, I will also point out to a couple years later when they did Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Right, which again is a show that you watch and you're like, how is that on TV? how did they? And the answer is, well, I kind of get it. It starts out as a murder mystery and there's a little bit of soap opera and it seems like it's going to be a normal show and it gets good ratings, so you bring it back and then you're like, oh no, what is this show that they made? Right, it's a very similar kind of thing to
me. You saying they didn't know what Twin Peaks was until the second season?
Well, no, I'm not sure that they knew
what Twin Peaks was after the second season.
I'm saying that the Twin Peaks even more than Max Headroom had enough ratings that they're like, I guess we gotta bring it back. Right, like I guess we gotta. And then but they're like still not quite sure what it is that they exactly got. I don't know, they were very daring at a time when shows like that didn't get on the air very many places. So credit to ABC for even making this happen.
Max Headroom got canceled because they only got 12 million viewers.
Only
12 million viewers.
Think about that.
That's all.
It's a bomb. Get it off the air.
I knew from the second episode when they went in on Missile Mike, I knew it was doomed. I knew that they were never going to get the kind of broad audience, you know, going that incisive about social issues.
Yeah. Anything else before we wrap it?
I just want to know where they sourced that stuff, because now you could just find it on YouTube. But in the 1980s, how in the hell did they find the whatever that is stuff is for Wackets, you know, or Missile Mike for that matter? Where did they find that stuff?
They said in one of the special features that one of those things, they just went around the corner to a Chinese restaurant and got like a guy that worked there and spent like five pounds on having him like do a zigzag promo.
Oh,
and
okay. So they just shot
like
all right.
Like all of those things, they as cheap as they found ways to do things that would get a lot more airtime, stuff that they knew they literally needed 10 seconds of, they found the cheapest, easiest way to just like shoot it in a backyard or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's like a couple of like westerns and a few other things, but for the most part it is really weird junk TV that like Moises is saying, it was knocked up so quickly that you could, if you looked at it for very long or if they showed more than what you see in the show, the seams would fall apart.
The belly dancer with the pigs. It's just amazing.
They bought that for a dollar.
Yeah, somebody went to a belly dancing performance and they went, hey, that's 5 seconds of interstitial stuff and we know that she has the costume, so we just need some pigs and then
we're
good.
That's the charm of the show, just weird stuff thrown at you for no reason. Like
it's Blank Reg's whole promise, right? It's now more of the same. It's whatever. All right, well, Max Headroom, if you're interested, you can buy it on all the places where you can buy TV, like iTunes or Apple TV app or Amazon. You can get it there. You can absolutely get the Shout Factory DVDs if you want to go all in on it. It's a great way to do it with a lot of great extras. There are ways to watch this, and you should. That's it. You should.
Indeed.
Thank you for all for spending 20 minutes in the future with me, Monty Ashley. Thanks for being here.
Every cent was spent correctly.
All right, fair enough. Moises Chuyon.
That's a callback to the thing he says
at the beginning. Yeah, I got it. I think they did. It does feel in a few moments like they ran out of money, but boy, they like Monty. Would I trade in the explosions in the helicopter? I would not.
They had a second helicopter. Agreed. You guys know that, right?
Yeah.
They had the helicopter and another helicopter to shoot that helicopter.
To shoot the helicopter.
Again, that cost a lot of money.
Oh my God. Moises Chuyon, thank you.
Jason, this is violent, very difficult to listen to, and it's going to be bigger than Scumball.
Oh, raking is going to be huge. Warren Fry, thank you for being here.
You're welcome, and the worst I can give you is a sloppy lick.
Cicero Holmes, thank you.
I don't have any good catchphrases, but thank you.
You're welcome. And Austin Rich, thank you for being on as our Max Headroom expert.
Well, I don't know about you people, but I'm going for a walk. I wonder where this wire goes.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. Yes, it was wonderful, wasn't it?